And we are now live.
Okay. Welcome, LTD ATU Pension Trust. We got some new faces here today, and hopefully some more showing up soon. Let me start with a roll call of the trustees. So let me get to my agenda. John Gangle.
Here.
Christina Hsu.
Hello.
Michelle Weber.
Here.
Mark Johnson, who I don't see, and Frederick Casey, who I don't see as well. I do know he's trying to log in. He's having some tough time with the link, so I don't know, Camille, if you could send him a new link that might assist in that effort. And myself, I am here. Okay, preliminary remarks from me. I want to say welcome to all the new trustees that are participating. Yeah, this is a very good committee that we're a part of. It does vital work for our members and for our employees at LTD. They depend on us to do a good job. They really do value this benefit, and they want to continue to see it be well-funded, well-managed, and continue to grow in the future. So I just want to set that for our new trustees and welcome you to the team. And, you know, we're a very open group. So if you have questions about anything that's spoken today, feel free to talk and speak up about that or write follow-up emails to our professionals here. They're always very helpful, and I think you'll find them to be well worth what we pay them. Okay, so moving on. I don't have any additions to the agenda. We do have a section here for audience participation. I'm looking to see if we have any audience attendees. I do not see any audience attendees. I will note that it looks like Mark Johnson has joined, not with audio yet, but he has joined the meeting at 11:02. Camille, I'm not seeing any audience attendees. Are you?
No, that is correct. I don't have anybody for this meeting yet.
Okay, well then we won't have to read through that whole public comment section on this agenda. And we can move on to the approval of the meeting minutes of the August 19th, 2021 meeting. Has everybody had a chance to look through the meeting minutes? And if you approve of them, I would entertain a motion to approve the August meeting minutes. And since it was only Chris.
Recommend that we approve the meeting minutes for the last meeting. They looked good. I read them, and thank you.
Yeah, and I'll second it since I was the only other active trustee at that meeting. So all those in favor, can I get an aye?
Aye.
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 Okay, all those not in favor? Not hearing any. So the motion passes to accept the August meeting minutes. Moving on, we have the report of the attorney. He gets front and center at this meeting. We got a couple of items that we need to approve here at the meeting, so we'll let Jeff go over those.
Sure. So in your packet, let's see, I'll try and share my screen. Not being a technophile, I don't know that I'll do it right, but hopefully I will. Can you all see? No, not yet. Can you now all see the document on the screen? Great. So there was a amended memorandum of agreement agreed to by LTD and the union. And on the last page of that, in section 9.3, it required in this paragraph here is saying effective January 1, 2022, it changed the multiplier in effect January 1, 2022 to $80. And so that was made here up at the first sentence, made subject to approval by the LTD ATU pension trustees. And so now coming before you is an amendment to implement that provision of the memorandum of agreement. In order, for ease of use, this amendment just includes the entire table from which this multiplier is taken. But the only change in the table is unless you adopt this amendment, the $78 will be in effect. But by adopting this amendment, you limit the $78 multiplier to the 2021 year and implement the $80 multiplier in the last line effective January 1, 2022. And so that's all this amendment is doing, is putting in place that new agreement. The document that you're looking at doesn't accurately reflect the trustees, but the executed version that you actually sign substantively will be the same, but will reflect the correct trustees. So that's the only action item that I have, and I'm certainly happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Jeff. I think it goes to say, you know, we're sticking with our historical norm of benefit increases going forward, up to 3%, which is what the plan's funded at. This is a little less than the 3% number that we're typically funded to increase, but it was part of our one-year extension with LTD during the COVID pandemic. And I do think the plan is funded to accept the $80 pension benefit credit for next year. I do appreciate you updating the form this morning with the correct trustees on the executed one. Getting it through DocuSign would be helpful if we can coordinate that to sign via DocuSign through Alex and HR, or maybe Ashley and LTD HR. I think that'll help make this process neat.
Yeah, from my perspective, that'd be great. Get all the signatures on the same page. It's nice and clean, and that works.
Anybody have any questions or any further discussion on this amendment? Otherwise, I'll entertain a motion to accept the amendment as presented.
Yeah, and I'll second that, Bill. I think we're good to go. It is what we agreed to, so.
Okay, I have a second on that. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion. All those in favor, trustees, say aye.
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 And aye. All those not in favor. Okay, motion passes. Well, that was pretty harmless there, Jeff. Glad we made it through that. Okay, so moving on to our next item on the agenda, we have our report of the investment consultant, Ian.
All right,
ready to go. Bill? We're ready for you.
Can you hear me all right? Okay. Let me share my screen here. So I know we've got a few new people in the room. So maybe, you know, going through performance this time, maybe I'll kind of explain things maybe in a little bit more detail than normal. But if you have any questions on the information you're looking at, please don't hesitate to jump in with questions. It's much easier for me to help explain things if I know what kind of the sticky issues are in terms of what you're looking at. But what we're going to look at today here is the Q3 performance report. So I'll go through capital markets update at the beginning here, just to kind of set the tone for what happened in the markets during Q3 or for the numbers that we're going to see today, to put that into reference, give you a little bit of a kind of context into what's happened since these numbers have been printed. So these are as of Q3 or as of the end of September. I will then go through the plan performance for the total fund is the main focus, but we'll kind of hit on some select nuances with certain managers, et cetera. But again, feel free to jump in with comments as I go through this. So on the capital markets update, we'll start with the slide that you see on your screen. We have some additional capital markets commentary in the 7 or 8 slides that follow this that go into a little bit more detail with what happened into certain asset classes like US equities or international equities or fixed income, et cetera. But I normally kind of keep my comments based on this page right here to go through kind of the highlights of the commentary for Q3. So largely Q3 represented a pretty flat quarter, all said and done. Equities were kind of modestly negative on the whole. If you look at global equities, inclusive of US and international, and fixed income ended up basically flat. And so what drove some of these concepts? Well, you know, as you have been used to seeing since essentially the COVID crisis ended in the, you know, or began really, excuse me, at the beginning of March 2020. In April 2020, going forward, you know, kind of absent of what we had seen in the economy, which was, you know, closing economies and basically pretty strong headwinds with respect to kind of economic data, well, markets actually did fairly well from April through about Q2 of this year. It pretty much steadily climbed up. Equities did really well in that particular time period, given all the stimulus that we got from the Federal Reserve, all the additional monetary, you know, measures that they took. It all fared pretty well with respect to a tailwind for equities, which are, of course, obviously the main growth engine of any pension plan. Now in Q3, we saw kind of some rocky or choppy markets enter back in. And so you can kind of see these numbers here on the bottom left box here that I'm highlighting with my cursor. S&P 500 was up about 60 basis points, so nothing terribly impressive. Certainly not used to the 5 or 6% returns that we had been seeing in the quarters previous to that. But still a strong year-to-date performance. And that year-to-date number is representative of January 1st through 9/30. So this quarter-to-date is just July through September. Calendar year-to-date is the entire calendar year that we're currently in. And then these trailing year periods are trailing 1 year, 5 year, and 10-year snapshots ending Q3. So you can see that the S&P 500 fairly flat. Small cap stocks represented by the Russell 2000 index were more negative. So smaller companies were hurt more in the past Q3 time period than larger companies would be as represented by the S&P 500. These next three benchmarks here represent developed international equities and emerging market equities. You can see those were largely flat too, with the exception being emerging markets. They also did not fare very well during Q3. And Bloomberg US Ag Bond Index, that's just a general benchmark for basically treasuries and investment grade corporate fixed income. And so why did emerging markets and small caps fare kind of not quite as well in Q3? Well, if you remember what happened in Q3, we had a much bigger explosion of the Delta variant. And that certainly weighed more on smaller companies and particularly on emerging market companies due to some of those supply and demand issues that we've been seeing. You've probably seen on the news, you know, some shipping containers stuck out to sea, not being able to get in. You know, inflation is a vicious cycle that doesn't necessarily have one thing contributing to it all the time. So we had a lot of money dropped into the economy by the Federal Reserve that, you know, if we're going to explain it real simply, that increased a lot of consumer demand for goods and services. Then we had a big supply shock with respect to COVID crisis and things getting out of a lot of emerging market countries and getting their way to the United States and getting their way to Europe. So we had the supply, so we had the largely the supply and demand curve shift in two opposing ways. We had demand shift up and the supply shift back. Obviously, that's increased inflation. I think you saw probably, or if you didn't see, you know, earlier today, we came up with a 6.2% CPI number for October, which was well above expectations. So biggest print we've seen since 1990. So You know, we are living in a time right now with some high inflationary pressures, whether this is going to be, you know, transitory or kind of short-lived as the Fed would hope it would be, or if it's here to stick around, you know, that's probably anybody's best guess. But we're certainly faced with some supply and demand issues right now, which are certainly causing the Fed to consider things like when they're going to taper bond purchases. They talked about this last week about how they're going to start unwinding that process sooner than later. And more importantly, probably to a lot of investors, is when they're going to lift off at the beginning of the yield curve. So this bottom right graph here shows the Treasury yield curve at different points in time, the green line being the end of September. The blue line was the end of June, so the end of Q2. You can see those largely lay right on top of each other. So that's a big indication of yields didn't move a lot from one end point of Q2 to one end point of Q3. There was obviously movement during the quarter, but they largely ended at the same place, hence why fixed income was largely flat at about 0.05 percent for the quarter. So when we see large movements in the yield curve, that is generally what drives fixed income prices. And so this front end of the yield curve you can see here is still pinned very much at zero. I think with inflation running as hot as it is, and as well as some of the economic data coming in pretty good over the last couple months in terms of unemployment figures and things like that, you might see the Fed get a little bit more aggressive next year with when they might increase short-term interest rates. So, you know, at the beginning of this pandemic, you know, 2020, I think the Fed was anticipating probably not making any yield curve or Federal Reserve changes until probably 2023 at the earliest. I think those expectations have certainly come in probably about a year or so. So I think most market participants are expecting the Fed to increase short-term interest rates here sometime in the next 6 to 9 months. So again, as of Q3, the numbers we're going to look at today, largely not very impressive. Equities didn't do a whole lot during the quarter. Fixed income didn't do a whole lot this quarter. Now, that being said, since the end of 9/30, so since the end of Q3, we've seen equities do really well. You've seen the Delta variant kind of subside a bit. You're not seeing quite as many headlines in terms of hospitals being, you know, heavily overrun. Corporate earnings actually came in pretty strong for the time post the print of these numbers. And so the S&P 500, for example, you can see here as of this print, the calendar year-to-date return was about 16%. It's actually up almost closer to 26, 27% as of today. So we've had a really good time period post these numbers. So unless we get something that dramatically shifts the market environment going into the end of Q4, you know, we've got about a month and a half left before the end of the year. You know, I would expect returns to come in for the plan, again, hopefully well above, you know, your discount rate or your investment return assumption. So again, barring anything massive in the market, it's been another really good year, even with a really flat Q3. Maybe I'll stop there. Bill and other trustees, if there's any questions on capital markets, I'm happy to cover those, or I can jump into performance of the plan.
I have no specific questions. It was good to hear some positive news post 9:30. So Q4 is looking pretty good. Even if we ended the year flat as we are now, you know, I'll take this year over some of the years that's sat here. So, you know, let's keep the good news rolling there, Ian.
Okay, I will jump forward. So here is where the plan sat at the end of 9:30. So how to read this is the left page here. We're going to show, you know, the market value of different, the total plan there at 40 million or so, the underlying composites and their quarter to date performance. On the top right, you've got your policy asset allocation versus, you know, the ranges or where it sits versus the target. You can see the deviations here denoted in red. We're fairly close to our long-term target. Nothing out of whack here. You know, really this is just due to market movements. You can see that domestic equity is a little overweight. Not surprisingly, given domestic equity has done a little bit better than international equity this year. So it is a little underweight. But outside of that, you know, we're within plus or minus 1% of our stated target. So nothing that's like triggering a rebalance right now or anything like that. At the bottom here is a what we call a schedule of investable assets. So we're going to say, what's our beginning market value for the year? So our beginning market value was about $37 million. We've had a net cash inflow of about $287,000. We've had a market gain of about $3 million this year. And so that ends us at this ending market value of $40 million and a year-to-date return of close to 8%. So again, you know, think about where the discount rate is and thinking about where your performance is. Even if the numbers chopped off here, you know, it's another calendar year above your investment return assumption. Now, I ran a few numbers through yesterday. So again, not going to be shown in this report, but you know, hopefully we get a nice another month and a half. But to show you how strong it's been in October and November up through yesterday, you know, estimated plan performance year to date is sitting right around 13%. So up another 5% over the last month and a half, just since these numbers have been printed. So another really good year coming in. You know, if we could chop the numbers off right now and just take off the end of the year, you know, I'm sure we would certainly do it, because 13% is a really good calendar year return again. So that's where we sit as of yesterday, but these numbers are obviously as of 9:30. So this page, I won't go through every single page, but quick update. This is where you sit versus your peers in terms of asset allocation. So in terms of other pension plans that are less than $100 million, how much do you have in each asset class versus where other pension plans are largely allocated? You can see you've got a little less US equity, a little bit more international equity, and quite a bit less fixed income. Now, these are tough numbers to say, you know, they're not necessarily decision drivers, right? They're just kind of like an FYI versus where you sit versus your peers. And the rationale here is there are a lot of peers in this plan that are potentially 100% funded, that are fully immunized, if you want to use some technical lingo. And they have a lot of fixed income because they don't have to take any more risk because they've essentially got 100% pension plan, 100% funded pension plan. We obviously have a gap still between the funding ratio, where we sit now versus a 100% funding ratio. So we've got to have something in the plan to drive some growth. And that's obviously going to come from our equity exposure. So that's the large differential that you'll see in terms of where you sit versus some peers. If I go a couple pages forward, this is what we call total fund attribution. So this is going to say, what did my policy benchmark do? That was down 67 basis points. That's what the second bar is. How did my total plan performance do? That's the top one right there. That's 38 basis points negative. So you were down 38 basis points, roughly flat for the quarter, but the policy benchmark was down more at about 70 basis points. So where does that differential factor in? Well, you can factor it in between three main driving components. Differences in your asset allocation versus your benchmark. We saw some of those a couple pages ago, some of those red bars, deviations. You're never going to sit right on top of your target unless you rebalance the plan every single day, which would be not a very good idea because you'd incur a ton of transaction costs and you'd lose out on any good momentum that the market has to offer. But largely, we sit pretty close to the target. So that's always going to be a number that's not going to contribute that much to your difference in total plan performance versus your benchmark. The differences that usually come in, and hopefully they come in positively, which they did here, is differences in style selection and differences in or where your active managers are adding alpha or outperformance versus their benchmark. And we saw positive contributions from both of those sections. And we can get into a little bit more of what caused that here in a couple slides. So on this next page here, again, we show a lot of different trailing time periods and of how different the total fund, different composites, and we'll get into managers here in a second, did versus their benchmarks and differences versus their peers. So at the total fund level, again, we can say, how did we do from, and maybe let me go, I'll keep it on this page for a second. So this is gross of fees. So gross of fees, we use gross of fees on this one just because the peer group, we only can get gross of fees peer group data. So we have to use gross of fees plan performance to show how the plan did versus other peers. You can see the peer median was roughly flat. You were down at about 38 basis points. So you ranked in the 75th percentile. Not great. We'd love to be above median, but I'll show you in a couple pages how tight that spread was for Q3 between first and 100th percentile. Calendar year to date, though, still really strong, right? We're up at about over 8%, well over the policy benchmark. That's our primary, you know, outside of trying to beat the discount rate every year, we're not as concerned with how peers are doing. We're concerned about how beating our policy benchmark. And we did here, we're above it by 170 basis points on a gross of fees basis. And that ranked us in the 29th percentile. But you can see here, the last 3 or 5 years have been really good. We've ranked, number one would be the best in the peer group. 100 would be the worst. We'd like to try to maintain a ranking of above median. Again, it's not a huge factor, but it's something we'd like to keep an eye on. And you've consistently, over the last, 10 years or so, ranked above median quite handedly, really, over in the last 3 to 5 years. So it's been a really, really strong 3 to 5 years. For some of you new trustees, you may have noticed in some of the documents how the funded status has gotten materially better over the past 2 years. And a lot of that is to do with some of these top line numbers coming in consistently over the discount rate on an annualized basis for the last few years. Then we can go into some composites, how they've done versus their respective benchmarks. And really on a calendar year to date basis, we have beat every composite has done better than its benchmark. So you can see here, domestic equity has done better than its benchmark. International equity has done better than its benchmark. Fixed income has done better than its benchmark, real return and GTAA. So it has been a really fantastic year to date period. Again, on top of what was a really good 2020 in terms of alpha or value add versus the primary benchmarks. And that has to do with the construction of the underlying composites due to the manager selection. So we can get into that here in a second. But overall, another really good calendar year to date so far. And looking at where the numbers sit as of Q4 so far, as I mentioned previously, probably another good Q4 coming our way. So here's the different managers that make up all the different composites. These top three are our domestic equity or United States equity managers. We've got one passive allocation, so meant to just, kind of reduce overall fees and track the market. And then we've got two active managers here. Dodge & Cox has had a really strong year. They're up about 800 basis points in ranking in the second percentile for that primary active exposure. Not as good of a year for HarborCap, but they're coming off of a really strong 2020. So, sometimes those things, rotate in and out in terms of market exposure, but still, if you look at the ranking over the 3-5 year period, we've got some really strong active managers in the portfolio that have added a lot of value versus the benchmark. These next three managers are the international equity managers. So again, got a passive allocation meant to just simply track the benchmark. Then we've got LSV and American funds. So a value and a growth component. And again, year to date, we've got some good outperformance for both those managers and still 3 and 5 years continue to rank above median. So some strong performance for our international equity components as well. On the next page, these two top managers are our fixed income managers. Again, we've got a passive component, but most of the fixed income money is actively managed. So that's about 2 to 1 or almost 3 to 1 actually in terms of double line assets versus Vanguard total bond. So double line, again, we've had a really, really strong outperformance year to date. That's added a really good value in a time when fixed income hasn't been doing much of anything. You saw that yield curve. We just really haven't gotten much activity on the yield curve. And until the Fed states or kind of gets into raising interest rates, it's a difficult environment for fixed income. It looks extremely expensive right now with yields being so low and credit spreads being so low. So Double Line's done a really good job of selectively adding some value there. You can see that they're about flat for the year in a year-to-date period where fixed income in general has been negative. So that's been another positive contributor for the plan. Finally, we've got, I failed to mention the AFL-CIO Housing Investment Trust is also in the fixed income portfolio, pretty small allocation. But again, it's largely tracked the benchmark this year, hasn't detracted terribly from overall plan results. And then the next two, we've got one real return manager. So that's PIMCO Inflation Response, and one GTAA manager, which is Globally Tactical Asset Allocation. So kind of a go anywhere manager, trying to find some opportunities within across all asset classes. PIMCO Inflation Response has done really well this year, as you would expect, in kind of a hot inflationary environment. They've got some commodities, they've got things like TIPS, they've got things like natural resource equities, all things that generally have a positive correlation with inflation numbers. So as you might imagine, those have done fairly well over this rising inflationary period. And PineBridge has outperformed, kind of a 60-40 blend is what we kind of benchmark them against. And they've added value year to date. They've added a lot of value over the trailing 1 year. So again, it's really kind of hard to pick any bad spots in the portfolio right now. Largely, they've all been doing really well. If we dig in a little bit more, I'm going to jump around here a bit into how that kind of translates into peer rankings. You can see here that we want to be at the top of this page, right? So this is our trailing 5-year rolling percentile rankings. And you can see we've done a really good job coming out of the great financial crisis of driving these numbers up. The diamond is where the total fund ranks on a 5-year basis, and the target allocation or your policy index is in the blue circle right there. So you can tell, one, we'd like that diamond to be as high as possible on the page, and we'd like it to obviously stay there. And it's done a really good job of trending that way. But secondly, we'd like to see this nice big gap between them and the target allocation index. That means we're getting some really good, strong manager alpha or outperformance for our underlying managers versus stated composites. So we're getting that as well. I'll kind of end on this page just to give you kind of a snapshot of how the plan has done over different periods with the rankings of peers. You can see here in that quarter to date period, what I was mentioning, you ranked in the 75th percentile versus peers, but you can see you really only had to be about maybe 50 basis points better in return to rank almost in the top decile. There just wasn't much activity in the market over Q3. So it was really hard to create some kind of large spread between different asset allocations. With equities being basically flat and fixed income being basically flat, there wasn't large deviations across peers. And you can see that here in the spread. But on a year-to-date basis, you can see ranked there at the top. And we're coming off, these are now calendar years, we're coming off a couple calendar years where we also ranked in the top quartile. So that is what's driving some of those really good 3- and 5-year rankings for the plan. I might end there. I think that's probably a good synopsis. Hopefully, if anything doesn't make sense on these, because you know, obviously for all you trustees, you know, this is kind of your bread and butter in terms of understanding the plan's performance, the plan's risk exposure and things like that. If you ever have any questions in terms of how to interpret these reports, you know, I'm always available kind of to go through it one-on-one with you, but also happy to entertain any questions right now.
Not seeing any hands raised there, Ian. I will note on the coming out of the Great Recession, that chart you showed previous to this one that's currently up, you know, it's almost a distinct line from when we really got our hands dirty and started really digging into this plan back in 2013 and 2014 to start kind of rebooting it a bit. And ever since that attention and keeping our 20-year horizon going forward, you know, we've been doing really well. And I just think that an engaged trustee and just encourage all the trustees to continue that engagement. Ask questions. Our professionals are very responsive. So if you do, like Ian said, you know, take them up on his offer, because we want to have engaged trustees, and that way we can have a better plan overall. So thank you, Ian.
Okay, thank you. That concludes my section, Bill.
Well, great. Well, then I will move on. to the report of the actuary.
Okay. Thanks, Bill. As noted on the agenda, we don't really have anything formal to report today. You're going to hear a lot more from us in the next couple meetings because we're coming up on the every 2 year valuation. So the January 1, 2022 valuation will be our next kind of big discussion item, big work product. And that sets the contributions for this plan starting in July of 22. So a lot to get done in the early part of next year, and we'll be revisiting with the trustees assumptions and implications of that valuation, which will reflect asset returns that Ian mentioned through the end of this year. So we'll see where we end the year, and then we'll get a snapshot and move forward in the next couple meetings. So nothing else for us today.
Scott, do you see any changes on some of the mortality tables and in your evaluation? You know, we're seeing a lot of discussion on mortality across the U.S. as impacted by COVID.
No, that's a really good question. Yeah. What we anticipate at this point for the mortality assumption is more just a standard update where every year there's new tweaks to the underlying kind of improvement projection. So that gets emerging data as it comes. But so far, like the long-term effect of COVID is still being worked out. Clearly, there's near-term or, you know, sort of in the rear view and still ongoing higher mortality, especially for certain groups that will come through and experience, you know, if it affects a given plan's population. But what that means for how mortality may evolve over the next few years, there's actually some things pushing in different directions. And so I wouldn't anticipate any big changes to our measurements for COVID-related mortality upcoming. The bigger assumption that we'll be talking about that we always talk about is kind of latest and greatest on forward-looking investment return assumption. And so I know we'll look to RVK for what their updated outlooks are. We've got colleagues within Milliman who prepare capital market forecasts. And while all the returns have been great over the last couple of years, that actually a lot of times means the forward-looking return is lower because equity PE ratios and everything are high now. And so we'll tend to see that where we may have, hopefully we'll have banked some asset gains, but may recalibrate going forward. That's typically kind of what we're seeing for most plans right now.
Yeah, I'll just make a comment on that, on our discount rate. You know, I was attending a session at the International Foundation virtual conference, and they were talking about setting your rate. You know, that's always a topic of conversation. And boy, we were at the low end of those attending. Still, there's still people up there in the sevens and, you know, some eights still around. I don't even know how that's possible. To see that we're some of the most conservative that we're attending was surprising to me. But also, I think it's just prudent that we're there already and we don't have to, you know, try to hurry to get there. So, which is interesting to compare ourselves to others. Any questions for the actuary? Okay, seeing none, we'll move on to our next item on the agenda, and that will be the administrator's report. Dean or Sarah?
Hi. Sent materials out this morning, did a few back and forths about the 65-35 split for Milliman. Or RVK, sorry, that's the one that we always do a 65-35 split on. And then Milliman is per plan. So no expenses out of the ordinary, with the exception of the repayment. There was an RVK portion of a bill that was paid by ATU. That should have been paid by salaried plan, but we through bill.com got it repaid. So
okay. Well, Sarah, while you guys are up, you know, we're having some transitions at LTD in our HR department and our benefits processing for retirement. And you know, lately I have been hearing that they've been slow. as they stand, and I want to make sure they don't get any slower going forward. So how can we make sure that when folks do decide to retire, that that's a smooth process? And, you know, what do we need to do on the LTD end to make it easy on you?
That's a good question. I don't think that's really been a huge issue. We did have some constraints recently just due to scheduling and things like that. People being out of the office on vacation and personal appointments and stuff, but I haven't had any issues or anything. I mean, I think we're communicating really well. So maybe I'm not aware of some issues going on on the other end. I don't really know.
I just know our primary contact for benefits processing will be transitioning out of LTD, and we'll have a contractor filling in for that going forward until it's filled.
Right.
So I just want to make sure that, you know, you guys have made contact and that they're checking with each other. You know, I think we did have a minor benefit slip up a few months ago, and that was on the LTD side, but you know, fixing those things takes a little time too. So just want to ensure that everybody's caught talking to each other and they know where we're at.
Absolutely. I am aware of the change, the transition. I have reached out, but I do not have the new contact as of yet, but I am in contact with Alex and everybody at LTD to be aware of any changes going on.
Okay. And I think we hired a contractor to help out. We can get you that name.
So yeah, definitely. I will. Quickly. I'll reach out. Yeah. That's everything I have.
Okay. Well, that was simple. No questions for the administrators, and we'll move on to new and unfinished business, and that is the COLA update. At the last meeting, we talked about getting, once we get all of our trustees seated, kind of having a review of where we're at with our COLA, some of the work that was done by the work group, and some of the history of when the last COLA was given out to AT retirees with some of our plan professionals. So I would just let you guys know, we don't have to decide exactly when that's going to happen today, but we'll try to schedule a meeting with our actuaries, Jeff, the attorney, and all the trustees to kind of go over where we've been on that. So it's just going to be a simple, like a work session, not necessarily a trust meeting on that one. But, you know, that's been a topic of conversation. We're seeing inflation being very high. We're seeing Social Security COLA is projected to be quite high. And the last COLA given out to retirees was in 2006. So it's been a long time, and their purchasing power has certainly diminished since then. And how do we find the path forward? And, you know, some of the overperformance is good in the plan. Do we capture some of that? You know, these are the topic of conversations that trustees we can have. So just want to put that on your minds. We're going to be talking about that going forward, just to recap, since we have so many new people on the plan. Otherwise, new and unfinished business. Anybody else have anything else they'd like to offer? Not seeing anybody? Okay.
You're doing great, Bill.
Thank you. You know, I will just recap John Hampton, most recent past trustee on the ATE side, and I attended the IFEBP virtual conference, pension and benefits conference that is put on yearly. We did it through Zoom. It was a little challenging in the first couple of days. I didn't have everything dialed in, but we did get our sessions in, so we got our education credit for the year. Hopefully next year we can do an in-person meeting. I'll work with LTD HR to ensure that every new trustee is signed up to be an IFBBP member. So you'll get the news headlines and the educational conference communication We usually go to the annual conference every year, but there are some more specific public plan conferences, if that's something we want to look at. But really, I think just getting started with a general conference for new trustees is a good idea, and that usually happens in October or November of each year. So just kind of keep that in mind. I'll try to get the dates out for the next one. I want to say it's in Las Vegas next year, so it's a pretty easy trip to make, and hopefully we won't have to talk about COVID protocol for that one. But otherwise, you know, virtual conferences are one thing. You know, I did get some out of it, but it's nowhere near as immersive and of an experience as attending in person. You don't get that camaraderie. You don't get the swap stories or hear other people's questions and get those answers. It was much much more stale just presentation wise. So I would recommend an in-person conference if possible going forward. It's worth a try though. Okay, well, that's all I had for today. I can start the calendar game. We can look at the next meeting. And usually we depend on Ian to kind of give us a range of dates when he thinks he'll have our investment information ready.
Yeah, Bill, I think we usually, last year, I think.
We were in February last year, I know that much.
Yeah, I'm trying to see. It looks like we were on the 18th. So, I would assume, if I'm looking at this, I would assume probably the week of, either the 14th or the 21st probably works, even the 28th, right around probably like middle to end of February is when we normally have it.
I know we typically try to avoid scheduling our pension trust meeting on the same day as the LTD board meeting, which is usually, I think, the third Wednesday of the month. So let's try to avoid that day, maybe the Tuesday or the Thursday before, but I'll defer to folks that have jobs outside of LTD to see how their scheduling and availability is around that time. Michelle?
I don't have my calendar in front of me, but a Tuesday or a Thursday is always best for me. So I think as far as the timing being discussed, either one of those would be fine.
Yeah, Bill, and I'm sure, Bill, technically the week of the 7th probably works fine too. So if, any one of those weeks.
Well, it's far in the future, but the 15th or the 17th of February, how are that looking on folks' calendar?
The 15th looks better for me, Bill, if you're asking.
Yeah, I am asking. Okay. And so the 15th going once, I'm going to do a 10 or 11. Generally, we don't like to do it right when we wake up. So 10 or 11. If it's going to be in person, we would try to shoot for an 11 so our plan professionals can make it down. If it's going to be on Zoom, then, I think we're a little bit more flexible on that. But let's just say 11 to leave ourselves some options on the 15th of February.
That works for me.
Okay.
Yeah, well, sounds good.
That sounds like a unanimous yes on the 15th at 11 a.m. For the next ATU-LTD Pension Trust meeting. With that settled, I'll conclude today's meeting. Thanks everybody for being here. I appreciate the work you guys do for us. And I appreciate all the trustees volunteering their time to be part of this meeting. I know our members depend on it, like I said in the beginning. It is a critical benefit, and it definitely put that in our hands to take care of them. And we always got to keep that front and center in our minds. This is for them, not for us.
Thank you.
Good luck with your next meeting.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi there, this is Christina, and we'll start the Pension Trust Committee meeting for the Salaried Employees Retirement Plan. I'd like to start with the roll call. So Michelle Weber.
Here.
Mark Johnson. Thank you. And I see we still have all of the consultants and advisors here. And it looks like Alex is not here yet today. I just want to welcome our new committee members, both Mark and Michelle. And I appreciate you both serving on this committee because it's really, as was mentioned by Bill in the last meeting, it's a really important meeting and it's a really important committee to be on for the help with the pension trustees' long-term retirement. So the next thing that we have is audience participation. Camille, do we have anybody in the audience who would like to participate?
I do have one audience member. I'm just going to give a second in case she is having trouble indicating she would like to speak. And no, I don't have anyone indicating they would like to provide testimony. Thank you, Christina.
Thank you. All right, so let's move on to the agenda. So the last meeting we had just AJ and I, and I read the meeting minutes, but I don't know if Michelle or Mark, you had a chance to read them and if you are okay with making a motion to approve those minutes. Mark, we had a really hard time hearing you. You were cutting in and out. I couldn't quite hear what you were saying.
Yeah, sorry.
Mark, you know, I don't know if it's me, but I was having a really hard time still hearing what you said. Let's do this. Were you trying to, can you indicate by raising your hand if you were trying to make a motion to approve the minutes?
Yes, I was making a motion to approve the minutes.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Thank you. All in favor of approving the meeting minutes? Aye.
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 Awesome. Thank you. All right. So we don't have any items for board recommendation. And I know in our last meeting, we talked about that Ian would give us any updates for things that were different from the salaried plan that he wanted to call out versus the ATU plan with regards to the investments, but that we wouldn't go through the entire presentation again, because there are many parallels between the two. Ian, do you want to report on the investments for the salary plan?
Yeah, sure. So maybe I will, just because we've got a couple new faces here, just real quick, my comments largely are going to be fairly consistent between these two plans, because for a long time, they had basically the same manager lineup and the same asset allocation. So they largely had the same plan performance. Recently, we've been talking about de-risking this plan for a little while, and took that opportunity to very modestly have this be a little less risky of a plan or a position. The risk tolerance level be a little bit lower than the ATU plan. So we did make some small tweaks in the asset allocation. So maybe I will go to this page real quick and kind of highlight what those are, because those will largely be the determining factor in what drives the differences in the asset allocation between these two plans. So the main difference here is you've just got a little bit more in fixed income than the other plan does, and a little bit less in equities in general. So that's really the only difference. The manager lineup outside of the AFL CIO Housing Trust investment, the ATU has, this uses the same lineup outside of that. So you can see here all the names here that make up the different composites are very much the same. Same investments, just slightly different weights. It has a little bit less equity, a little bit more fixed income. Since this is a closed plan, it is a maturing plan, obviously faster than the ATU plan. Well, we felt it more prudent to advise on just a slightly less risky position in terms of asset allocation. So going forward, the results will be a little bit different, but not much. You can see here at the bottom page here, this was actually did a little better overall the year-to-date period through 9/30 because of didn't have as much equity exposure that was largely a little bit negative in Q3. So while the ATU plan was up 8.04, this was up 8.11. It's just kind of a reference point to see they're not drastically different, but they will deviate slightly. So this was up 8.11. I would say, Christina, my only other comment is similar to how I gave kind of an update on the previous plan on how it had been doing through close of business yesterday. Again, just an estimate based on what our calculations are in terms of where manager performance has been through yesterday, is about in the 12.7% range. So again, close to that 13% mark year to date, still very, very good, ranking really well versus your peers. So again, that would probably be my only comment, but happy to answer any other questions if there are more nuanced questions on the performance of the plan and or capital market.
Thank you, Ian. Does anyone have any questions for Ian?
Okay, Christina, I will stop sharing my screen then.
Thank you, and thanks for I like seeing the very positive returns on a regular basis, so thank you.
And maybe one other note is, Christina, we did, I'm sure you noticed, but we included in the minutes similar per the discussion last time, similar commentary in terms of the full commentary I gave in ATU, but applicable to this plan. So those will be reflected in the minutes for this plan going forward.
Thank you. And this plan has, I think, what it is, maybe Scott or Lacey will recall, but I think we're like at 86 or something percent. So where this is a funded or something like that. It was a little better than the ATU plan is my recollection. But the next thing is we have the report of the actuaries. Scott and Lacey, do you have anything you wanted to add?
Yes, so we do have an item, and I can share screen here for to talk through some of the topics from our letter that was in the board packet. Give me a minute here. Lacey, in the meantime, while I'm doing that, do you want to respond to Christina's question of what was the funded status you mentioned at the last meeting?
Right. So our estimate of the funded status at the meeting in August was 84%. That was based on the prior valuation completed 2 years ago. So we have an estimate of the liabilities at that point, but no remeasurement. What we've done now with the July 2021 valuation is to collect the data on the current plan population and refresh that liability number. So we'll talk about specifics for the valuation results in the letter that Scott has up on the screen now. But I think for this valuation, we're looking somewhere around the range of 70 to 73 or 4% funded, depending on the assumptions that the trustees select today. So that is a bit different than what we talked about a few months ago, which again was just based on assets and not updated liabilities. But it is a still significant increase from the funded status in the last valuation, which was only 67%.
All right. Okay. Can everyone see my screen here with the letter that was from the board packet?
Okay. Yes, looks good.
Great. We won't go through every section of this in detail, but I'm happy to address questions as they came up, if there are any from reviewing this prior to the meeting, but do want to hit the high points. As Lacey just mentioned, we're in the process of the July 1, 2021 valuation, kind of have all the work that we do for that and have it done, and now are coming with a discussion of assumption updates for the board to consider. As discussed here under the summary recommendations, the trustees really have authority over the assumptions that are used for the valuation. This valuation then produces the recommended contributions to the plan. Ultimately, under the funding policy, the Lane Transit District Board of Directors authorizes the payment of the actual amounts, but that's sort of the division of labor. So the trustees here select assumptions to use for this purpose to get the recommended contribution, kind of based on advice and recommendation from ourselves and from RVK for the asset side of things, certainly. So that's kind of the context for today. Before we get into some of the details of the assumptions, it's just worth noting that really the long-term cost of a pension plan is governed by what we call the fundamental cost equation, what we show here at the top of the page, that the benefits and the expenses that have to be paid out of the plan come from one of two sources, come from either the contributions to the plan or investment earnings on those contributions. Now, the investment earnings, like the long-term cost is driven by actual investment earnings, but our most important assumption in the valuation is what we're assuming those are going to be over the long term. So whether we set a little higher assumption or a little lower assumption on this point will affect what our recommended contribution in any given valuation is. But to the extent actual returns come in above or below that, it's course correcting over time. So as noted here, if investment earnings underperform compared to the assumption, then contributions are going to increase over time and vice versa. So that's just kind of perspective on where we're at. The current investment return assumption for this plan is 5.5%. I'll jump ahead to a little bit of background on that. That reflects for Christina, you'll recall 2 years ago in the discussion here, the trustees made a significant change to lower the forward-looking assumed return from 6.25% to 5.5% at that time, based on where sort of capital market outlooks were. Clearly, in the 2 years since then, on an asset basis, returns have been quite good, but that also does mean, as we alluded to in the prior meeting, that the forward-looking expectations from a lot of sources are kind of tamped down relative to where we were 2 years ago. And that's what's shown in the chart here at the bottom of this page. We illustrate two different forward-looking kind of median expectations from Milliman for a 10 and a 15 year based on our kind of capital market colleagues. And then a number that RVK showed from a presentation earlier this year. I don't know if there's any update from that from Ian, or I think usually it's early in the year when RVK refreshes. And then the last item shown here is a horizon survey, which is really takes results from 39 different investment advisors and kind of gets them together as a average and a median. And where 2 years ago when we were discussing this, all of these numbers were in sort of the 5.4, 5.5, 5.7 kind of range, everything's a bit lower now, given that equities have continued to run up, PE ratios are high by historical standards, interest rates are still low. And so the Milliman numbers shown here using a 2.5% inflation are about 4.8% or 5.4, depending on what time period you're looking at. RVK had a 4.7% median expectation with an inflation assumption of 2. And the Horizon survey, it was a little over 5% with an inflation assumption of about 2.1%. The plan's current inflation assumption has been 2.5%. I'd say, 2 years ago, there was some discussion of whether that should be coming down as forward-looking expectations for inflation were a little lower. As Ian already mentioned earlier today, inflation expectations right now with very high current inflation, but unsure how that's going to play out. You know, we don't feel uncomfortable with the current 2.5% inflation at the moment. So all this is just to say, you'll see when we get to the exhibit in a moment here, and Lacey will walk through sort of the details of the effects of assumption changes. This is a big assumption for the valuation. The current 5.5%, while not unreasonable, is now sort of on the high end of what the expectations for this asset allocation and most recent capital market outlooks would suggest. So it's something the trustees could consider bringing down, be a little more conservative, a little more likely to have outperformance rather than underperformance going forward. And as you'll see when we get to what that does to the recommended contributions, since we've had good returns over the last couple of years, there's downward pressure on those recommended contributions. Getting more conservative with this assumption would push them back up a little bit, but still, depending on where you choose, could still be lower than kind of the steady state assumptions from 2 years ago. So I'll pause there for any sort of initial questions, and then Lacey will walk through what this means in more detail for the results of the plan. Any initial questions? Okay. All right. Jump ahead to the exhibit with all the fun numbers.
Thanks, Scott. One thing I also should have mentioned when we were talking about the difference between our August estimate and the numbers you'll see here today for the funded status is what we call the actuarial value of assets versus the market value of assets. When we do estimates between valuations, we commonly use the market value of assets because that's an easy number to get to and it's measured throughout the year. The actuarial value of assets is defined in the plan's funding policy and includes smoothing over a 2-year period. So as you can see here in kind of the top part of the page, when we did the valuation 2 years ago, those numbers were really close together. There wasn't much difference between those. But since we've seen really good returns over the last plan year, we have a much larger difference between the actuarial value of assets and the market value of assets, since the returns from the last year are partially deferred into the future. So, I mean, it's about, $3.2 million. That's a significant amount of money that's not being recognized yet in the funding percentage. And another note on the returns, we are doing everything here on a plan year basis, which is aligned with the district's fiscal year from June through July. So the returns we're looking at are for the plan years ending in 2020 and 2021. For 2020, that was about 2.7%. For 2021, that was about 28%. So both of those are being smoothed here into the actuarial value of assets, which is used for the valuation. So when we remeasure the liabilities, we reflect the current population of the plan, who's still active, who's retired, who's left active status with the district. And we project all of those people out into the future and calculate their liabilities. So reflecting the new population had a small impact on the liability. That's going from the 30 million shown in column one and the 30.4 million in column two. Yeah, thanks Scott for following along with me. That increase is actually a little less than we were expecting, which we refer to as an actuarial gain, meaning the plan is in a slightly better position than we were expecting it to be. That's primarily driven by salary experience for these 2 years, meaning that salaries were slightly less than we were expecting them to be. It seems like projecting those out into the future based on the data we have, there's a little bit of a correction there. So we don't see any need to reflect any updates to the salary scale at this point. The other big change is obviously the actuarial value of assets. So the improvement there combined with the slightly higher liability means that the shortfall or the deficit of the plan decreased from $9.8 million to about $7.7 million, which is a huge improvement in the plan. And again, with the funded status that we talked about, that brings us from 67% in the last valuation to 75% in the last valuation. You'll notice here in that header that it also says this reflects the updated administrative expense assumption, which we'll talk about here in a second. But there's no impact on the liability or the assets just by changing that assumption. So even though it's folded in here, that's really to tie into the contribution, which is on the next page, which we'll get to in a few moments. So without changing any assumptions, if everything else were to stay the same, we'd be significantly improving the funded status of the plan and still having a significant chunk of asset gains to reflect in the future as well. Okay, so for our proposed changes to the assumptions, there's really three that we want to talk about today. Two that are pretty insignificant compared to the size of the plan. And then of course, the assumed rate of return that Scott has already mentioned. So quickly, we'll talk about those two smaller ones. The first is the administrative expense assumption. Plan expenses can be paid out of the trust assets, which is why this is something that we include in the valuation. Those are included in our actuarially determined contribution, which again, we'll talk about on the next page as well, but no impact on the liability. So the current assumption was adopted, I believe, 6 years ago when there was some rebalancing between what is paid, I think by the administrator or paid to the administrator between the two plans. And we've noticed in the past few years that may need to increase a bit. So we're just suggesting increasing it by about $5,000 from $75,000 to $80,000. The next assumption to briefly touch on is the mortality improvement scale. When we talk about mortality assumptions, it really comes as a package of two pieces, a base table, which reflects historical mortality experience, and what we call a mortality improvement scale, which is projecting how we think mortality is going to change in the future. A small plan like this doesn't have enough data for a small population to really build a credible mortality table itself. So we rely on large studies published by the Society of Actuaries to help us find assumptions that are appropriate for a plan like this. 2 years ago, we switched to the SOA's private plan table, specifically with a white collar adjustment. They produce white collar, blue collar, and all sorts of different adjusted tables. And we felt that was the most appropriate one at the time. We still feel like that's an appropriate assumption. So we're not recommending any changes to the underlying base table for the mortality assumption. We are recommending a change to the projection scale. That's published every year by the Society of Actuaries with updated data. So we're suggesting that the trustees adopt the MP 2020 table. So that's the table that was published in 2020. As of the valuation date, the 2021 table hadn't been published yet. And so we're not using that one. And there really isn't much difference between the two of them when it comes to a plan of this size. As you can see here, the impact, this is in column three, of the mortality change is to slightly lower the liability. This is because that projection scale is producing slightly lower life expectancies overall. And in a plan like this, it really is immaterial when we're talking about a $30 million liability. So an increase... the decrease in the expected lifetimes means a decrease in the liabilities and a slight decrease to the deficit. It's not really materially enough to move the needle on the funded status at this point. Okay, so then the last assumption to discuss today, the biggest one, biggest impact, is the assumed rate of return that Scott talked about earlier. We're suggesting that the trustees adopt either a 5.25% or 5% assumed rate of return. So a small decrease compared to the 5.5% current assumption. You can think of it almost like a teeter-totter. As you decrease your assumed rate of return, the liabilities increase because you're assuming that less will be earned in the trust going forward. And we're using that rate to discount the future payouts of the plan. So in this case, the impact for each of those 25 basis point steps is about $800,000. No change on the actuarial assets. So that will increase the deficit and slightly decrease the funded status of the plan. Okay, before I move on to talk about the impact on the contributions, are there any questions about these assumptions that we have suggested for the trustees? Okay, I'm not hearing any. So we can talk about, I think probably the punchline here is the contributions. What happens when we change all of the assumptions to the contributions that we're going to recommend the district make to the plan? So Scott, can you actually scoot to the next exhibit where we show the most recent contribution? Okay, great. So this shows kind of a history of what the district has been contributing to the plan over the last 10 years or so. You'll notice in the plan year ending in 2017, there's kind of a significant bump in that contribution. That wasn't due to the valuation. That was a year where the district decided to contribute over and above the actuarial determined contribution. So that's kind of where that spike is. But you'll notice in the years after that, it still remained higher than in the prior years. That's due to assumption changes and changes in the population throughout the course of those valuations. So the last year that we have, the year that just ended in 2021, the contribution to the plan was a little under $1.5 million. So that's a number to keep in mind as we're considering future contributions, just so you know kind of where that level has been and where we're suggesting we go in the future. Scott, do you mind scrolling back up to the, yeah, perfect. So if we were to make absolutely no changes to the contribution, we would expect the plan year, let me take a step back. The contribution is split into two pieces. We've got a percent of pay, which currently is 16.9%, and a flat dollar amortization payment. That percentage of pay is what we think the contribution needs to be to cover the accrued benefits that we think everyone will accrue over the next year. The $1.1 million amortization payment is intended to fund the plan back up to 100% by paying down the deficit over a specified period. As of this valuation, we have 10 years remaining in the fixed period. And we'll talk a little bit more about the amortization period a little bit later as well, since that's something that the trustee should consider in the future. So if we were to keep that contribution rate going forward, we would expect the, I think that's the plan year ending in 2023, to be about $1.4 million or a little bit more than $1.4 million. This valuation sets the contribution rate that starts in July of 2022. So that's why we're talking about the plan year that ends in June of 2023. So folding in the experience on the liabilities and the assets there in column two, the asset returns obviously puts downward pressure on the contribution rate, would bring it down to about $1.3 million. The mortality in column three, that also puts some slight downward pressure on the contribution rate. So that would be just under $1.3 million. As we move to column four and five, that's where we are updating that assumed rate of return, which puts upward pressure on the contribution rate, bringing it back up to around 1.4 million at 5.25 and about 1.5 million around at 5%. So all things considered, compared to the current contribution going from 1.5 based on the 147 that we just saw in the last fiscal year, that's about a 5% increase, I think, in the contribution. And so that helps hopefully manage budget volatility for the district, but still puts the plan in a really good position for capitalizing on the asset gains that we have and continuing to well fund the plan into the future. So I think at this point, the action for the trustees, like Scott talked about, was to approve these proposed assumptions that we've talked about today. That will go back to us so that we can finalize the full valuation report, which will set the details of the actuarial contribution. And that goes to the board for approval into the district budget.
Thank you, Lacey. Mark or Michelle, do you have any questions?
I don't have any questions. But thank you for all of that.
I don't have any questions at this point.
Lacey, I have a couple small questions. Sure. I remember you were showing the one with regards to inflation, and I know you have this assumed deflation of like 2.5%. Mm-hmm. And is that for every year over the 10-year period? Is that what the assumption is?
Right. And that's a long-term assumption.
And if that, if inflation, because I know I've been hearing that potentially inflation could continue and be higher, what does that do to what we're looking at here?
I think that's a really good question. I'll let Ian speak to any potential impacts on actual asset returns in the future. On the valuation side, the inflation assumption can kind of have two different effects. One is on the salary scale. If we were to assume that inflation over the next 10 or 15 years would be higher than 2.5%, we'd also probably adjust the salary scale assumption upwards, assuming that salaries paid to current active members of the plan would keep pace with inflation. Mm-hmm. The second piece of it is that it's an input into our model when we're calculating the the assumed rate of return in the future. So that's where we talked about it earlier when Scott was showing that table. So it has, I think, a bigger impact on the assumed rate of return side than it would on the liability side. At this point, the plan is pretty mature, so most of the liability resides in inactive participants, mostly retirees. So even a slight increase to the salary scale for actives wouldn't have a huge impact on the liability for the plan.
Okay, so it would increase the potential return, though, because if you had inflation, because is that what you're saying? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So it'd be great if Ian does want to weigh in here at all, but just to revisit sort of this table in that context, typically what we see for capital market outlooks that are developed, there's kind of a real return component and then an inflation component. And so sort of A plus B to get to this nominal assumption. So if you were to, you know, take, for example, our number or the RVK number and try to adjust them to be apples to apples on inflation, you would move, say, the RVK number here up 51 basis points, and same thing for the nominal return, because they mm-hmm. tend to work that way. But, and Ian can certainly speak to this a lot more, how that would actually play out if we have, you know, the next 2 years inflation continue to be really high, how that plays out throughout the market for near-term returns rather than sort of this long-term expectation model mm-hmm. could go different ways. You know, have it's gone different ways in historical periods, stagflation or inflationary growth periods. And so there's, you know, short-term asset experience is complicated, certainly. But sort of this kind of modeling exercise, these pieces tend to go together when you're talking about longer term expectations of where inflation and where nominal return expectations are.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe I would just add, like, to their point, like, you know, we're probably talking about two different things here in the context of what you're looking at and in the context of like what plan assets might do under different inflationary periods. You know, I think you just heard probably the more important concept, which is long-term modeling results for liability purposes. But, you know, in the short term, you know, historically high inflationary periods or periods of rising inflation are generally not very good for a lot of the building blocks of pension plans, mainly fixed income and equities. So, mm-hmm. You know, equities tend to be relatively flat from a real return perspective over increasing inflationary periods. If you look over historic, even over the past 100 years, now that's not to say that that's can't change in the future, but generally equities are pretty flat from a real return perspective when you're rising from already elevated levels, which we somewhat are at right now. So we will continue to see inflation run hotter. That's probably not that great for equities. It's actually worse for fixed income. So, mm-hmm. you know, with another kind of diversifying asset class. So that's why we have exposures like that real return component within the portfolio, because that's probably the one piece of the puzzle that's actually going to do well in higher inflationary times. So, you know, we've got that at about 13% target of plan assets. Mm-hmm. If we were going to get inflation that was going to run hot for longer, they've got inflationary inflation sensitive areas like commodities and tips and natural resource equities and things like that that are in that portfolio that are going to do well. But we wouldn't expect equities and fixed income to do very well. Now, that being said, you know, you're just like every other pension plan who's, you know, in no way would it be prudent to try to make some inflation call and move everything over into some kind of inflationary, you know, sensitive component, because if we don't get inflation or we reverse off of inflation more toward the Fed's stated target, those are not going to be exposures that are going to do very well. So it's just like any other diversifying piece of a portfolio. We're trying to build a portfolio that is going to do well under a lot of different scenarios, but we're not trying to make macro calls here and say, you know, we think inflation is going to be hot for long, so we're going to dramatically shift the course of the asset allocation. You know, we're really just trying to say, let's build a diversified portfolio that under a lot of different circumstances is going to reasonably expect to get you close to your discount rate. Mm-hmm. But again, we're going to have wild fluctuations around that discount rate in any given calendar year. Okay.
All right. And if I understand correctly, I just want to make sure I'm making sure I understand what you said. For the most part, the pieces related to admin salaries and the piece related to the MP 2020 table have very little impact. So the main change that we're talking about that has an impact is just to change the assumed return of either 5 or 5.25%. And that our goal has historically been to fund it in a 10-year timeframe. And so is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. And so that, and all of the comparisons that you provided were, the highest was at 5% and the low, and then all were below that, in a 10-year timeframe.
Are you talking about the discount rate, that the lowest discount rate? Yes. So we're the assumed rate of return is also used as the discount rate in this type of valuation. So that's why it's impactful for the liability calculation. So we're suggesting either 5.25% and or 5% for that assumption. And just a note on the amortization period, that was set 10 years ago. So mm-hmm. as we move forward, probably into the 2023 valuation, so the next 2 year cycle, that will be a larger topic for the trustees to discuss and consider in order to manage volatility. As that period shrinks, the contribution volatility can increase, and also make sure that the plan is still on track to be fully funded while there are still active participants, ideally. Mm-hmm. On average, we expect the current actives to work 8 more years, which is slightly less than our 10-year current period. So that can play a factor into how we set up the amortization period going forward.
Does that mean that our returns would shift more, like the asset allocation that Ian does, we would shift more than he has already to the fixed income to make sure that it's covered in the shorter time frame? Or I guess I don't know what that means.
Well, I can let Ian handle the question on the asset allocation. For the amortization piece of it, amortizing the unfunded liability, there are a number of different options. You're not locked into this amortization period. It's just what was set in the funding policy when it was made. Mm-hmm. Scott, did you have other comments you wanted to make on that?
Yeah, I think the asset allocation discussion is going to be an ongoing one for a mature plan, but I think it's somewhat separate from this. The amortization period, as Lacey alluded to, it was set 10 years ago. At that time, moved from being a 20, we decided it would go from being a 20-year amortization of gains and losses to a progressively shorter one, shrinking every period. So what we would call a closed and declining period. And now we're down to 10 years. So any new good or bad experience right now is being amortized over 10 years. And that just means how quickly it comes through in this contribution. And so we think that's fine for now. Next valuation, we'll want to look at it because we'll be down to 8. If we get much below 8, then any good outperformance or underperformance year may make the contributions more volatile than we think are necessary. We want it to be responsive enough to fill in any shortfalls. But if you get down to the extreme of where you don't have an amortization period, then you're just potentially filling very big buckets or taking gains all in 1 year. And that's definitely not where we want to be. Even for a very mature plan, you want to have some degree of stability to the contributions. So it's kind of that sweet spot that we're looking for.
So Scott, would that mean we would have to increase? And I'm thinking the reason I'm asking these questions is I do long-range financial planning for the district. And so I'm thinking about, well, this is fine for the next 2 years. I can put in the 1.5 million. But what about for the out years? If what you're saying to reduce the volatility, are you saying that that we should count on an increased contribution over the, if you shorten the liability to 8 years or 6 years or whatever?
Not necessarily, because really, if assumptions are met, the level that we're talking about here is going to be pretty similar going forward. But what we'd be talking about is if we get losses in the next 2 years, and if we get, especially if we get losses that we're already, as Lacey mentioned earlier, kind of holding back some of the asset gains in the asset smoothing method. So we've got a little bit of kind of a tailwind for what this will look like in 2 years ago because of that. But if we were to get losses to mean that we're in a worse funded position in 2 years, with either a 10 or an 8 year amortization period, that's going to put upward pressure on the contribution rates by itself. And it's just a matter of sort of how much it does. If it's a 8 year period, that would push up a little bit more because you're paying it down over a shorter time frame than over a 10 year period. So it's really what's going to determine whether the 1.5 has to go up or go down in 2 years is what the experience is. And then it's really just kind of the method for how quickly you're trying to recognize that gain or loss.
Okay, thank you. And Jeff, I see you have your hand up.
Yeah, and I'm certainly weighing in on areas that I don't really know about. So these are, take my questions for what they're worth. Is the assumed rate of return aimed at, you know, trying to, I guess, estimate what the trust will actually, what the actual return is expected to be? And if so, Does Ian's statement earlier that we've moved some to fixed income, and my impression is maybe there would be more to fixed income, does that, you know, help affect whether to stay the same, go to 5.25, or go to 5% assumed rate of return?
No, I think that's a good question. I think the first part of that, the answer is yes, we're trying to get a good reasonable estimate for what the plan is expected to return. We do reflect the asset allocation of the trust. So that, in other words, the shift that's happened to fixed income is reflected in here because we're reflecting that in the mix of fixed income and equity that we use behind those kind of median expectations that we showed earlier. If things shift further to fixed income, in some ways it kind of depends when they do and under what conditions, because this is all a snapshot in time. If we were more fixed income than we are right now, that would all else equal push down the expected rate of return at the median of this. And so that might be an argument for reducing the rate a little bit further. But you know, as that happens over time, if the fixed income shift comes in a year or two and we've had inflation and rates are in a different spot than they are now, I mean, the whole analysis could look a little different. So usually the focus is on what the trust looks like right now, unless there was going to be a really near-term drastic change.
Yeah, Jeff, I'd probably just say like Scott hit that perfectly, but you know, not one thing necessarily hinges on everything else, right? You got to holistically look at the whole picture. So you've got to look at the funding percentage, you know, the health of the plan, you know, what, you know, in a perfect world, I mean, you can always like think about it, like in a perfect world, you just fully fund it, you know, today, you know, and like if you could put that much money into it, you see some corporate plans have done that over past years where they've just had an excess of cash flow and they've closed their pension plan and they say, okay, we're just going to toss a bunch of money at this so we don't have to deal with it anymore, and largely immunize it. But absent that, you know, perfect scenario, you're always going to have some level of uncertainty in terms of needing to take some kind of market risk to try to close the gap in funding if you're not just going to completely fund it via contributions. So it's a prudent balance of saying, you know, the reason why we shifted a little bit more to fixed income at this last asset allocation period is because we've had a number of really good years that have dramatically kind of cut down that the health of the plan. So we were afforded an ability to say, okay, now's a time where we can take a little bit of risk off the table. We still have to maintain some kind of market risk. Like, and that's just a fancy way of saying, you still got to have some kind of equities in the portfolio to be able to try to drive growth. But again, it's not one thing that necessarily hinges on the other. As Scott put, it's a point in time estimate. Every point in time we evaluate, you know, what your actuaries are telling you, what the market is telling us. You know, right now the market's telling us that everything is really expensive and not looking great for forward expected returns. So, you know, we can't afford to at this point to say, let's push everything into fixed income, because I would, you know, returns aren't looking better than 1 or 2% probably right now for the next 10 years if we were going to buy a fixed income portfolio and hold it for 10 years. So there's a lot of little kind of checks and balances that we do along the way. And that's why we look at these a lot of times. That's why we look at asset allocation every year. We look at capital market expectations every year. We're just trying to prudently make that balance between how much risk do we need in the plan, but minimizing that to the extent that's prudently possible. I don't know if that helped clarify things, or Scott, if I went a little too deep into that.
I think that's great.
So, Mark, do you have a question?
No, I don't. But I, you know, as you know, I'm out of town and I'm kind of balancing a couple of different meetings, and I'm going to have to go. So,
okay. I think we have to. Unless I'm wrong, I think we have to make a motion to either pick the 5.25 or 5% return. Is that for them to complete the actuarial valuation?
Right. We would like direction to know how you'd like us to, what you'd like to adopt for us to use for the final valuation here.
So, Michelle or Mark, do you have a preference for one of those two?
I'm actually, go ahead, Michelle.
Oh, no, you go ahead, Mark. You're the one that needs to jump out of here.
I'm actually fine with the 5.25% assumed return.
And I was just going to say, I'm kind of new still to, you know, the board in general, and definitely to this committee. So I would trust Mark and Christina's judgment on that one.
So, I mean, I was leaning towards the 5% because that was closer to what all of the returned that Milliman and Horizon and RVK had come up with in terms of their, what their thoughts was, and that it's only in terms of the contribution that we would be making from what we do today to what we would be doing under the 5% as a district it's very close. They're both 1.5 million rounded. There's a slightly difference, but it's only like $60,000 or something like that. But yet we would be having a more conservative assumption to make sure that the plan is funded over the 10-year period. So that was where I was leaning, but
yeah. No, it doesn't surprise. I actually could have picked that you would go with the 5%. and actually, I'm fine with that too. If you're more comfortable with that, I can move the rule, you know, except the 5% assumed return going forward.
Okay. And Michelle, are you okay with that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I probably would have leaned more towards the 5% as well. So sounds good to me.
So I think we need to, I guess that's a motion to use the 5% as assumed return as the direction. And is anybody, I guess, does somebody want a second to that motion? I guess I can make a motion.
Could I just jump in just for clarity, Scott and Lacey? It sounds like you also want approval of the administrative committee expense and mortality update. And maybe it's just assumed that that's in the 5% as well, but just for clarity, maybe make sure that the motion includes that.
Yes, that's correct. That would be great.
Okay. So I will make a motion to accept the assumptions made by Lacey and Scott with regards to the increases to the admin expenses and the mortality MP 2020 table, and as well as a 5% assumed return at rate. Can I have a second?
Second.
Anybody not in favor? All in favor, I guess, aye.
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 Okay. I think that is that was the main thing. I mean, is there anything else, Jeff, that you want to talk to? Think, or Scott, is there anything I missed that you still need to go over?
Nope. I think that covers it.
Awesome. Then I think the last two things are, Jeff, do you have anything for legal?
I do not.
And Sarah, I think is there anything you wanted to talk about, or Dean, about the administrator's report? Okay, I don't think we have any new or unfinished business, and that we already set the new date for the next meeting in February. So I think we are able to conclude this meeting, unless anybody has anything else that they need to cover. Sorry to keep you so long, Mark.
No, that's okay. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you, Christina.
Bye. Bye, everyone.
Thank you. Bye. Bye.